The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have made an engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. At least it is still morning here in California. Welcome to our Friday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Great to be here, and we thank you for listening. A couple of quick announcements, and then off to our program. For those of you that would like to give us a call and talk to our guest, who I will introduce in a minute, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners. Let the phone ring. Be patient, and I'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. In addition, you can check in with us on email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And in addition, you can go over to the right side of our website homepage to upcoming shows. This program is the first one listed. If you open up that show's website page and scroll down, you can post comments on the blog for our guest, and I'll read them on air. And that's another way that you can share your thoughts with us for this morning's program. At thespaceshow.com, that is, of course, our website, so there is a very detailed website newsletter. You can't possibly miss the link for it. It's on the right side of our homepage. That is updated every Sunday afternoon after the Sunday Space Show program. Not only does it give you the details of the programs for the coming week, it also has the upcoming show schedule. So if you scroll down a little bit further, you'll see what we have planned between now and the end of the year. And there's just a few dates left in October, but we're actually booking mostly now for November and December. It's hard to believe that we're booking toward the end of the year. This year just seems to have traveled faster than even SLS will travel to Europa. Everything is archived. You can listen right off of our website or easily download our programs. There is a menu in the upper left-hand corner of our homepage, and there's a couple of things of interest. Under the support menu is our store, where you can get Space Show t-shirts, coffee mugs, dog clothing which says the Space Show on it, things of that nature, baby clothing. So check it out. I hope you find some items of interest, and we appreciate your support. Listen live instructions are there in case you want to tell friends how to listen to a Space Show program. There are other websites and items of interest in that upper menu, so do visit it. In addition, there is a Support the Space Show button, and you'll see PayPal links for that. Remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with one, O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. Your gifts to the Space Show keep us on the air. I'm not exaggerating, and without your support, we would not be here. So please do support us. Remember, as a 501c3, if you are paying federal U.S. taxes, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true if you are in California paying California taxes, as we are a California public benefit corporation. Amazon is another way you can support us. You'll see a big Amazon button in the middle of our homepage. Excuse me. They have two programs in which they can support nonprofits. One is their Smile website, and this is an identical website to the regular Amazon site, identical products, prices. All of that is the same, except you are allowed to identify the nonprofit of your choice, and One Giant Leap Foundation is listed among your choices. If you select One Giant Leap and you go into your account from smile.amazon.com, Amazon will donate a portion of your purchase price to One Giant Leap Foundation. The other way is to go through the Amazon One Giant Leap Foundation portal. All of this is explained if you click on that big Amazon link. And if you're an Amazon user, as I am, this is a great way to support the Space Show with what you're doing anyway. And we certainly do appreciate your support. We podcast, so you can pick us up through iTunes and a host of other places on the web. If you do have any questions, let me hear from you. We do thank GigaDial for providing us with this service. Email is the best way to get in touch with me on these things, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we have sponsors, and do check out their banner ads going across our homepage from time to time. And today we have the Integrated Space Plan doing the first segment. They have a new banner ad, by the way, so do check it out. This is a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. You can see how their technologies and destinations build upon one another, and you can explore hundreds of individual elements. Go to their website, thespaceplan.com. They have discussions and updates and other ways to participate with the company, and you can even purchase a copy of the plan in one of two different sizes. So again, their website, excuse me, thespaceplan.com. And Orbital ATK is a sponsor. They are a global leader in aerospace and defense technology, and they are considered to be the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And with that, I want to introduce a new guest to the Space Show. We're very happy to have on board Casey Dreyer, and he is the Director of Space Policy at the Planetary Society. He leads the strategic planning and implementation of the Society's policy and advocacy efforts. He works closely with the Society's leadership, including their board of directors and other policy experts, to craft the organizational positions about the future of space exploration. He also works to foster strong relationships with the Society and its members, educate and engage the public about their space policy, and to empower individuals to advocate for space. He contributes to the Planetary Report, blogs regularly about space policy issues at theplanetary.org/blogs/Casey-Dreyer, and he tweets at Casey Dreyer on Twitter. He has a BA in physics from Oberlin College, and it is a pleasure to welcome him to the first of what I hope will be many Space Show appearances. Casey, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm well, David. Thank you. And I just want to say I feel excited to be here. I've listened to your show for a long time, so I feel like I'm kind of, you know, made it into the space community being on the Space Show. So thanks for having me.
Well, a real pleasure. Thank you. Let's talk Europa, because NASA made this big announcement, and we talked about it on Hotel Mars a couple of days ago. So there are water plumes maybe on Europa, which may help facilitate this mission. Does it help make it bulletproof from a new Congress or a new president if cost-cutting is on their mind? Do you think that that's an enhancement and a facilitator that makes the Europa Clipper mission really solid?
I do, and I think these are the types of things that you need, you know, or these kind of serendipitous discoveries that act, you know, kind of in retrospect as these tipping points. I think the real tipping point was a couple of years ago in 2013 when they first announced the discovery of plumes at Europa. And, you know, you can go back even further to the Mars program, the robotic Mars program. The tipping point, I would argue, is the discovery of the Allen Hills meteorite, right, that looked like that implied that maybe there was biological activity or this kind of, you know, highly suggestive that got the data that got people thinking and the public really excited, kickstarted NASA's Mars program. I think the discovery of plumes at Europa, which suddenly could theoretically help you answer this really big question about Europa, is there life there without having to drill through miles of ice? I think that was, in a sense, the tipping point for getting not just a couple of congressional representatives, but everyone at NASA, everyone in the public saying, this is something that we could do in our lifetime. And this most recent, you know, confirmation, follow-up, you know, NASA kind of, despite saying it was a very surprising result, it was, you know, is basically saying we used a different method and found matching implications based on the first detection. So it's not quite as big as that tipping point, but I certainly think that that finding plumes again, which they haven't been able to do in the last couple of years, is just, again, this is I call it the overwhelming amount of evidence. Like, what more does Europa have to do to really get us to go out there and explore it? So I think it's just great. Anytime this happens, it's great news for the program. Though I would argue that at this point, the mission has very strong political support, namely from the chairman of the Commerce, Justice, and Science Subcommittee of Appropriations. They write the legislation in the House side, that covers NASA, NOAA, the National Science Foundation, and a variety of other kind of a grab bag federal agencies. He loves Europa. And I think with him in that chairmanship, Europa is going to be solid no matter what.
Listeners, just to bring to your attention, there is some clipping and cutting on the phone line. And when we come to the break, I'm going to call him again and see if we can't get rid of that. But it's not anything that I can control. So you are going to hear it, and I apologize for that. And when the break comes, I'll try a different phone line and see if that makes a difference. But I just wanted to let you know, don't play around with your computer. It's something coming in over the phone line. When you read the NASA press release, and I asked you about this on Hotel Mars too, but NASA's saying this time around in looking for these plumes and using the new method, they found them on 3 out of 10 passes, so that's a 30% record. So is that a good percentage for finding things in space? Is that really calling out and saying, come explore me, or would they be better off if they had found them on 7 out of 10 passes or 8 out of 10 passes?
Yeah, I mean, I think the more detections, the better, just because you just get more data and you understand it. I mean, clearly the big problem actually with these Europa plumes, as opposed to the plumes on Enceladus, say, is that these are highly variable and apparently difficult to predict when you would see them. I mean, I think the reason that NASA PR, I think, used surprising, it was probably a poor choice of words, but it was because this particular set of observations was actually looking for an exosphere at Europa. They weren't actually specifically looking for plumes. And so hence the surprising thing. And so, the plumes kind of popped up, and they've done specific observation runs on using the Hubble, specifically looking for plumes, and they haven't found them yet. So the plumes are clearly not understood well enough when you see them, why they're at some spots in the orbit and not others, why they're visible at some points and not others. So it's not something you can necessarily design a whole mission around, because at this point, I don't think we have enough data to plan that we could make a fly-through of them. The Europa Clipper, which is currently in the early, phase A of development, in the early formulation stages, but it's an official mission now, hooray, 2015 is when that just happened. That has a mass spec on it that's going to be able to, I believe, fly through. If there are plumes, they could use it to fly through the plumes themselves. And also it's going to be looking for the exosphere, the haze around Europa as it flies by. So, I think obviously the more data, the better. But it's one of those just mysteries of Europa. And I think, just kind of Europa likes to clearly keep its secrets a little close to the chest by, wrapping this giant ocean under this giant thick ice shell. And it makes it just hard enough, right, to figure out the big question.
When we say looking for life, are you talking what, simple molecules or something really extremely primitive and basic? Or I know you're not talking about sentient life, unfortunately, but what are they talking about? How advanced would life be if they found it on Europa?
I think the consensus is we would expect very simple life. And this is actually a really interesting question just in general, right? If you astrobiologists and other biologists who study early life on the Earth, to get to complex life as we have it now, you have a series of highly improbable events that happened after, billions of years. So for the vast amount of Earth's time, we were nothing but simple bacteria and archaea, not even cells, right? Active, like complex cells, just very simple single-celled organisms with no nucleus. Then the nucleus, cells with the nucleus came about. No one knows exactly why. That's one of the big mysteries in biology right now. And then you had the idea of complex animals coming out from that. So you have these series, but for what, I think around 3 billion years of Earth's history, it was just simple non-nucleated bacteria swimming around in our oceans. And so that implies, again, we only have one data point, but that implies to astrobiologists that complex life is very rare, right? It takes a lot of happenstance and a lot of things to go right, basically to understate it, to make this happen. So I think they would say, you know, there may be, you know, and you have a variety of opinions, you know, and there's tons of opinions and there's a lack of data, but there's, I think most people expect that you may find life may originate quickly. They think it originated quickly on Earth, which implies that maybe life could be common at a very simple level, but no one knows how common complex life is. And so I think most people, I'm not expecting fish. I'd love to see, you know, I'll take them if there's European fish are swimming around. But I think most people are going to expect simple microbial life, just like on Mars. I think they would be expecting simple microbial life in the past, if not hanging on somewhere in some underground aquifer or ice, you know, below the ice.
Wouldn't fish be complex life, or are they?
Yeah, that's. I'll take them if complex life exists. I'll be happy, you know. I'll be happy with a microbe. But I think the likelihood of, you know, the more complex you get, you know, you just drop off by orders of magnitude. I think what the expectation is for people to of scientists is that we'll find those there. But again, we just don't know. I mean, that's the big question, right? I mean, that's fundamentally we don't have enough data. You know, we've learned over time that, you know, general science and understandings of how nature works applies on Earth as it applies to the greater cosmos, right? We started doing that by looking at the stars. We figured out that physics and orbital mechanics and motions of things seem to be the same out in the cosmos as they were on Earth. Then we started using, you know, spectrometers, and we realized, oh, look, there's the same chemistry that's out in the cosmos as we find on Earth. And then we started sending robotic probes to our planets and like, wow, you know, geology is this, you know, similar functions and forces of geology out in the cosmos as there are on Earth. And, you know, the one big question now, biology, is that a similar process? Is that a fundamental part of nature, a self-organizing principle given the right conditions? Does that apply out in the cosmos as it has on Earth? And that's one of the questions I think we can actually basically say we can directly test that hypothesis by going to Europa, because it has all those conditions right there, essentially, you know, in our, you know, own cosmic backyard, as opposed to some exoplanet hundreds of light years away.
Here is your first question of the day. It is an email from Jerry, who says he's in Cleveland, and he says, since there seems to now be a push to find life on Europa, does that put Europa in direct competition with plans to go to Mars? Is there money for both, or are we going to have to choose Europa or Mars?
That's a great question, and that's been obscure in a sense. So this, we can actually talk about the history of the mission that NASA's working on now, the Clipper, or just any actual robotic mission to Europa. You know, you have this process that's been around since 2001, called the Decadal Survey, and it's a report that's generated by a group of scientists and led by the National Academies of Sciences. And you get a bunch of planetary, NASA does this for every one of its four major science divisions, astrophysics, planetary science, Earth science, and heliophysics. And you get a bunch of scientists of your, top scientists in your field in a room, basically, simplifying greatly, but, you know, and basically they just argue about what are the big questions in our field, what are we trying to solve, how could we solve these in the next 10 years, or how could NASA solve these questions or ever start to answer some of these questions in the next 10 years, hence the decadal part of the survey. And they provide this very big report. It takes about 2 years to put together, and it ranks the most important missions as as determined by the scientific community. You know, it's a really nice process, and people, it's a highly respected process. So you've had two of these come out, one in 2003 and the most latest one in 2011, both applying kind of a few years down. So we're in the middle of the second decadal survey recommendation. And the first one that came out for planetary science ranked a Europa mission as the highest priority, highest non-Mars priority. And then Mars is kind of seen as a separate silo because of the ALH stuff and big programmatic commitment already made to it. Notably, we don't have a mission to Europa yet. They never got around to doing it, most likely because they didn't have the money because they were working on Mars missions. Now, in the most recent decadal survey that came out 2011 or 12, you have a top rank. They just mushed it all together. The top-ranked mission was a mission to start caching samples at Mars for large missions, and then the second-ranked mission was a mission to Europa. And for both missions, they basically said, you know, as proposed to the decadal survey committees, they're too expensive. So, you know, we recommend doing these in these order, but NASA needs to lower the cost. And if there's money left after doing the Mars one, we highly recommend pursuing Europa. And so you have this, basically they're proposing a two-for-one flagship mission in this decade, and that's kind of where we got. They got the cost of the Mars, we call it Mars 2020, it's a caching mission, right? They got that down to around $2 billion. I think the original proposal was $3.5 billion. The original proposal for Europa Orbiter in the decadal survey was about $4.7 billion. You know, big one, that would have been a juicy mission. And they actually figured out a very clever way that's modeled after how Cassini flies by Titan. So instead of orbiting Europa, you actually just fly by it a ton of times. And, you know, by using your clever orbital mechanics, you can actually get a global map to almost all of your science that you would by orbiting. But you save a ton of money by not being directly in this incredibly harsh radiation belt that's around Jupiter. And so they cut the cost down to the estimate from $4.7 billion to about $2 billion. So, okay, great. We have a two-for-one flagship mission. Both of them got down to around $2 billion. So we started working on Mars 2020. Or what would become Mars 2020, and then the White House just, boom, slashed the budget of the Planetary Science Division at NASA back in 2013. I mean, this was a very harsh budget cut. This was about 20% down and in 1 year. And it decimated, actually, the Mars program. It made a Europa mission just completely infeasible because of the budget was cut so deeply. And it was the only science actually to be singled out for that cut. This is before sequestration, for everyone who remembers everyone's favorite budgeting issue. And so you had this, basically you had a really bad situation in the outer planets because Cassini's ending in 2017, New Horizons is way out past Pluto, basically turning into a heliophysics mission after it flies by that Kuiper Belt object. You have the end of Juno in 2018, and that would be the first time in 40 years, basically, that NASA has not had some kind of presence in the giant planet. That was the end, you know, lights out in the outer planets. So it was a pretty dire situation, and obviously you couldn't even, you know, this is when the society got really involved, getting this budget back up, really pushing for Europa as one of the key drivers of that budget, and NASA kept saying no, no, no. They would even put into their budget request outer flagship planet section. It's like, we are not requesting money. There's no foreseeable way in the future we can make this mission happen. Basically, stop asking us about it. Kind of unique in budget requests. And so what happened was this guy, John Culberson, from Texas, that's on the Appropriations Committee, loved this mission and just started writing into the law every year, putting aside tens of millions of dollars for a Europa mission, basically keeping it on life support. And the great thing about what he's doing, and this has obviously gotten to the point where NASA finally accepted that there would be congressional support, not just to take money from somewhere else and give it to Europa, which was the fear. He's adding money to NASA's budget to support this Europa mission, that gem, or very broadly. So far, we have not had to choose, which is finally getting to his question. So far, we have not had to choose between the Mars program and the mission to Europa, because the congressional support we've had has been so good, and I would say smart about this, that they're not making enemies by supporting this mission. They're finding new money to bring into NASA. They're actually raising NASA's overall budget from the president's request to accommodate this. The big challenge is going to be in the 2020s, because Europa, ideally, this mission to Europa is going to be the first of many to the ocean worlds in our outer solar system, right? There's this whole movement going on right now to create an ocean worlds program, kind of modeled after the Mars exploration program on the robotic side. And what we want to do is say, you know, you can use a heavy lift launch vehicle like the Space Launch System, and you can say, because you shave off so much time in your transit, you can actually do these regular cadence of missions to Europa, Enceladus, Titan, Triton, you know, all these global oceans and the other planets. Get there in a couple of years, feed forward what you learned into your next series of missions, and really start to advance and march through to your outer planets looking for life. And you have this opportunity here to do that, but at the same time, that's when we need to be getting our samples back from Mars, right? This is our sample return. We're doing part one with Mars 2020, going to collect and prepare samples and lay them on the surface to come get in the future. And the hard part's landing, grabbing those samples, launching back up into orbit, and somehow taking those back to Earth. So you're going to have two competing aggressive budget lines in the next decade. And that's where I think the challenge is going to be to try to accommodate both of those while maintaining, don't forget, our just broader exploration program, small missions, Discovery-class missions, New Frontiers missions, and, you know, just a generally healthy science portfolio. So long way to say, so far we haven't had to make that choice. In the future, it's going to be more tough.
How solid is Culberson's district to keep reelecting him?
He had a primary challenger this year. It's one of those, it's a very, so he's a Republican, and it's a very red district, suburbs of Houston. And he has been, I believe, in Congress since the early 2000s, if I remember correctly. And he had, I think, the strongest primary challenge he was just this year. He ended up beating them pretty soundly. And I think, so I feel pretty confident that he'll continue to represent that district and represent the, and continue to be the chair of the committee, though I believe he is term limited in the chairmanship for a total of 6 years. I think he ends in 2022. But he could theoretically go up to the chairman of the entire committee by then. It's hard to say.
Well, that assumes a Republican stay in charge of the House.
That's correct. And that's a pretty good assumption, at least until the next census, because the last time they 2010, they won a bunch of state houses. They did a lot of gerrymandering to give them Republicans a significant advantage in congressional elections. And it's actually very hard to, I don't think anyone is actually feasibly saying that the Republicans are going to lose the House. That's their kind of stronghold at the moment. So should you have a bunch of Democrats win in 2020, they do the census, you have a gerrymandered step back away from the Republican Party, you could feasibly have a loss of the House. But until then, it's a very difficult political push to get that part. They're pretty entrenched.
So the last time a Europa topic came up on the space show was about 4 or 5 weeks ago, and I think it was with a JPL guest. I'm not sure if I'm remembering that correctly. And he was talking about using SLS, which is their rocket of choice, and it's travel time to Europa. And then a listener wanted to know, okay, if they went up on an Atlas V or a Delta IV or a Falcon 9, what happens to the travel time? And, you know, it's almost twice as long. And they started challenging what the guest was saying about it would be better to go with an SLS and spend a whole lot of more money but get there quicker than taking your time and saving the money and doing other things with the money for a better Europa mission or maybe a better Mars mission or something like that. So go over with us the advantages of SLS over another rocket, and also in light of the fact that it costs a lot more to use SLS.
So SLS, yeah, this is fun because SLS has obviously a lot of controversy around, particularly in the space community, but it has a significant amount of support within NASA and within the political kind of coalition that supports NASA, right? Big problem with SLS at the moment is that it does not have enough of a manifest to keep it launching frequently. We have two missions on the books, kind of EM3 is kind of a pseudo mission. Obviously, there's a lot of things you can do with it, but these human missions cost a lot of money, right? They cost more than science missions by the function of you have to build an Orion. You have to keep humans alive and so forth. It's just the way it is. So the advantage with Europa, a mission to Europa, is that, and even an Ocean World program more broadly, is that you can solve, you basically, it's your two birds with one stone kind of situation. You want to get institutional support for going to Europa. I mean, remember, NASA was not fighting for this Europa mission. You had a congressperson, he gave almost $200 million to NASA over 4 years, and the agency kept avoiding committing to this mission. So they would spend $80 million in a year, and it was no mission, right? It wasn't actually for, you can't make a long-term contract, you can't actually get this process going. There was not a lot of institutional support. NASA was not fighting for this mission. So, you know, I thought it was a little ridiculous, but they had other priorities, right? This is fundamentally, they had other priorities. So what if you can say, can we solve or address a priority? Can we align Europa with a priority of NASA leadership and to a degree that they would fight for this mission? And so one of the thoughts was, what if Europa can provide a use case for the Space Launch System? Europa benefits, the mission benefits by you cut down your travel time in half. You save some money because, don't forget, there's an operational cost to keeping a spacecraft just healthy, even during cruise phase. You're spending, I don't know exactly what it would be for Europa, but we can use Juno, I think, is a good example. That went on to Jupiter. They were spending $25, $30 million a year during its cruise just to keep it has to pay salaries of your engineers, your flight operations, your scientific team, you know, everyone, they drop salaries. So it's not free to go and spend, you know, 7 years in cruise phase. You pay for that. So some of that's diminished.
Do you know what they paid for the cruise period for the almost 9 years or so to New Horizons? Was that different?
It was somewhere, it varies year to year, but it was in the order of teens to 20, I think. So 15 to 20 million a year, I think. I'd have to go and check, but it's similar sort of, more than $10 million a year.
Okay.
So that adds up, right? And that's part of your primary mission you have to budget for. And so there is some even that you get to avoid building a spacecraft that doesn't have to have the thermal issues of flying close to the sun and Venus and all these places and the inside of the solar system, just go direct out. And you say to NASA, hey, you got this rocket you've invested a ton of money in. You have a problem that it can't launch fast enough. Well, here's a mission that can uniquely benefit from the capabilities of your heavy lift rocket you've just invested in. And once that message started to be made, you saw that resonating within the political support of the community, and NASA itself, I think, at the very top leadership, began to see that Europa was a not just a valuable scientific mission, but could be used to solve some of the more immediate problems. And that's just how, when you're working with a big federal organization, that's when I think things really happen if you can tie things to top priorities, either national priorities, administration priorities, or just a, leadership priorities. Mm-hmm. So there's a real advantage there by connecting these two.
Let me ask you another question on this. Is there, or do you know, the percentage risk rate of instrument problems and failure on the longer cruise time versus the shorter cruise time? Because if something goes bad on the way to Europa, then when it gets there, it doesn't have that instrument, or that instrument is partially curtailed because it spent 7.5 or 8 years getting there rather than 3.5 or so years. So is that a risk, or is that really a non-issue?
I'm sure they have engineering models of this and risk assessment. I'm trying to think of any actual situation where that's happened. Maybe the closest I could think of would be Galileo's main antenna not deploying correctly. There may be some other subtle ones. But, you know, I think NASA's pretty good at, you know, making these instruments last a really long time, right? They always over-engineer them to last beyond their prime mission. You know, same with New Horizons, right? That's, you know, beyond its prime mission. That's been out there for, what, 13 years, 14 years now?
Yeah, a long time.
And Voyager, you know, I guess is your ultimate one. And so they're... I don't think that's a... I'm sure it, at some level, adds risk. It seems to be one that they can tolerate or at least design around.
So now the question is, and I'm going to put on the hat of the new space cadets, unless they start to call in or email in to you. I don't know who listens to any particular show. And they keep challenging... whoever says this, that you would be better off using a cheaper rocket and the longer cruise period, even with the cost of the cruise time, as compared to spending $1 billion or so for the launch. So you're talking about maybe $220 million for an Atlas V or a Delta IV, and maybe $70 or $80 million for a Falcon 9. And then even if you had $200 million in cruise time, you're still only spending maybe a third to half of what you're spending on SLS. So is spending a half a billion dollars more important? Is it more important to get there in a shorter period of time just to have SLS? Or is it better to maybe spend $500 million on the project and not to waste money on something like SLS and to get there in 7 or 8 or 9 years? After all, Europa's not going anyplace, nor maybe is Earth not going anyplace as far as we know.
Well, I think it's a function of, so I think it even goes deeper than that. You can say, is it worth paying extra to exist as a mission? Right, I mean, and this is where it really comes down to, would this mission be on the books in the same way if it didn't solve if it didn't address a broader problem that has very strong political support? And I don't know the answer to that. I think you would have less of a chance of this mission being on the books right now if it didn't. And so that's, I mean, this kind of goes to the, deeper to this question, because it's bandied about quite a bit, right? And, you know, why spend $2 billion a year on this rocket when that money could go to commercial sector to develop a bunch of stuff more cheaply or broadly spread out throughout NASA? And there's a fallacy in that argument, which is, would that money continue to flow into NASA if this project didn't exist? And I think that's a highly questionable assumption because, obviously, right, the SLS is... We can just accept that, sure, it's some pork. It goes into a lot of districts. Well, that's important, NASA. But, you know, this is how things work in a discretionary spending in a democracy. When your representatives choose to fund things that they don't have to do, it makes sense. Of course they will bring some money back to their districts, right? That's how you're supposed to act as a political representative. You want to keep your community strong. You want to have jobs in there, right?
Right.
So it's not always a de facto bad thing. And the question is, can you properly align these ways of spending money in people's districts with still advancing the process of space exploration? So I think SLS is actually, you know, I'm generally more of a defender of the space launch system than a lot of people because I appreciate the political support that it's brought to NASA. Much more broadly, and it's a question of it's going to be a very stable program politically for at least a while. So can we use that to drive science, to drive exploration? And again, the question is, who's paying for it? To me, the question, it's more of a function of if, you know, back in the 80s, right, or the space shuttle was a quote-unquote free launch to space for a lot of science missions, right? It was all book kept and paid for by the human exploration side or the human spaceflight side of NASA. The science side got to, you know, pay very little or almost nothing to catch that ride into space. Same, I think, is going to end up happening. You know, if you want to say that the SLS, you're going to charge the Planetary Science Division $1 billion to launch in the SLS, then you functionally have no customers, right? Just because it's not a, you know, they may want to use it, but they're not going to be able to come up with the money to pay for it. So at some point, some of that overhead is going to have to be, I think, covered by human exploration in order to enable people to use their rockets, so in order for them to use it for their human stuff. And so I think there's a, that's a fine balance, and I think that the real goal would be to say maybe Planetary Division pays the equivalent of an Atlas V or a Delta IV to HEO, and then HEO underwrites the rest as part of its overhead commitment to the program. And I think there you have a pretty good balance of some money coming back, but also keeping it affordable. You save your time, you use the rocket, you have that political support, you build a coalition to enable missions like this to continue in the future. So that, this is where I see this as a political layer. If we ignore that political layer, I think we do that to our peril. And, you know, this is why, you know, this, in a function, this is just, again, how I think discretionary funding works in democracies. You know, some people who have the power to direct that money, they want projects in their areas and their states, and, you know, fine, let's do it, and we'll just make sure it does something good, like go to Europa.
So I guess what I'm hearing you say is that not only do economics and the science play a role in this, but because NASA is for all practical purposes and this process is very political, the political aspect of being able to fund these missions and get them on the books in the first place is probably as important to their existence as the good science and technology. Am I hearing you right?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. And I think this is where this is kind of one of my hobby horses in my position, is that I really think people and us and everyone listening as space advocates, the more savvy we can be, and you don't even have to agree with my particular take on this, but the more we need to be very aware of the politics and the opportunities and the pitfalls and problems of politics, is that the underlying issue is, and I think that you put it very nicely, it's almost as important as the science, right? Because again, you look at Europa, the scientific argument for going to Europa has not really changed, right? They've known that it's a big ocean, or they're highly confident there's a big ocean there, highly confident that it's a great opportunity to look for life. They've known that since, basically, I think Voyager, Galileo really confirmed it. And it took, 20 years to get a mission on the books. And it wasn't until kind of a conflation of opportunities of the right person in Congress, the plumes is kind of your kicker, and then your opportunity to solve a problem institutionally for NASA. I think this all came together, and we got this flagship mission on the books after a decimation of the planetary science budget. Now, you have a more broad, you can look and see this all over the place, right? Look at a near-Earth object observation. It was at $4 million a year at NASA, right? Despite congressional direction that you have to find all asteroids 140 meters or larger, NASA, they weren't giving them any money to do it. NASA wasn't really requesting any money to do it. They had a small program doing some process, but they weren't going to make their goal. Right now, we're spending 50. Suddenly, we're in the last few years, we've gone up by an order of magnitude up to $50 million a year on near-Earth object observations. Why did that happen? Well, really the inflection point was when the president started to call for asteroid exploration and the asteroid redirect mission. Once you had a programmatic goal of NASA aligned with a smaller program, that smaller program benefited, and we've greatly increased the amount of asteroids we're finding now, even though we're still probably spending too little. It's one of those things where you can see this all over in history. When the politics, when you can align your program to the political priorities, you have a better chance of being funded. And I think that's just a process of being, again, in a large government organization that answers to politics fundamentally. And this gets very different when you talk about private companies who don't have to answer to the same way. But I think we have to be aware, at least for NASA, that that's a part of all of this.
I have one more question that's come in, and then we're going to pause and take our break. So Jack is in Ogden, Utah, and he said, I'm at work, David, not using the phone. I know that on some missions, the Planetary Society has an experiment or some sort of an instrument on board as part of the mission. Are you planning anything for the Europa Clipper mission?
Not at the moment. I think it's one of those things where the radiation environment, too, will just kill you. You have to have that radiation hardening. It's going to make it very tough. But nothing at the moment. And I think it's always something we look into for those opportunities. But no, unfortunately, that would be a fun one. But I'm just happy it's going.
Listeners, stay where you are. We'll be back in a couple of minutes with our guest, Casey Dreyer. I am going to try for a better phone line. And don't go anywhere. Again, about 3 minutes, and we will be right back.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Friday Space Show program with Casey Dreyer. We're talking primarily about Europa, but also planetary missions and SLS. We have two sponsors for this section. So AIAA is one of our sponsors. That's the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. They are the world's largest aerospace professional society. They have 30,000 or so individual members from 88 countries and 95 corporate members. They help shape the future of aerospace every day, advancing the state of aerospace science and technology, increasing our knowledge of the universe, and bringing the world closer together. Check them out at their website, AIAA.org. And then Celestis is also a sponsor. And they are the global leader providing memorial spaceflight services. And as I said on several shows, I am a customer of them, having had my mom and my dogs go to space with Celestis. They're just an incredible company. But they are also widely known for their services, and they also get featured in a lot of different public and popular cultural events. Major media outlets around the world covered the first flight, and this was 1997, a long time ago. And on that first flight was Timothy Leary and Gene Roddenberry of Star Trek. The New Yorker magazine published a cartoon about the launch. The flight was recorded in the Guinness Book of World Records and was even added to the board game Trivial Pursuit. Noted personalities from U.S. Senator John Glenn to actress Susan Sarandon have recommended Celestis to friends and constituents. Actors including Jonathan Frakes, Patrick Stewart, and Tom Hanks have announced their own interest in a space funeral. Star Trek's James Doohan and Gene and Majel Roddenberry will also fly on the Celestis Deep Space mission, and they have been featured in movies and popular music as well as game shows, including the old show To Tell the Truth that some of you may remember. So check them out, Celestis.com. It's a great way to honor someone who has passed away that had a passion and love for space. And if you want more of a personal testimonial, email me. I'll tell you all about my experiences with Celestis. They were absolutely incredible. Casey, because SLS got thrown into the mix, I take it that there was more support for the Europa mission. Does that mean the Europa mission was finally clear sailing with strong winds blowing it forward?
At this point, we're in the best position we've been in, but it's an interesting history, again, just how often we've tried to get this far, I guess. I mean, you saw back going, you can even go back to George W. Bush's vision for space exploration. In that vision, there was a huge project to Europa, GMO, the Jupiter Icy Moons Observer, I think. It was a Project Prometheus, for any of your listeners that remember that, a nuclear fission reactor in space that would use these advanced engines. I think a $16 to $18 billion ultimate price tag to go out to Europa. Europa was a core part of that vision. Again, it was a top priority for that decadal survey. And studied, no mission. Then they picked up again and said, well, maybe we could do a mission with the Europeans and build some political support with the Europeans. Early 2007, 2008, they were studying a Europa orbiter, and Europeans would do a Ganymede orbiter at the same time. They could do joint science together, studied, no mission, pre-phase A for all of your engineers who followed this, but basically no formal commitment. And so I have no idea how much money they've spent over the decades, but it's got to be hundreds of millions of dollars over the decades of studying various missions for Europa. And again, the science never changed, right? It was still the top priority or the top place to look for extant life, I would say, in the solar system. Tons of reasons to do it. Never got there. And you had the situation where the Europeans basically threw up their hands and said, fine, we're just going to go alone. And to Ganymede. So they started JUICE, the Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer, and that's going to be going to Ganymede in 2030, I think is when it's going to get there. The mission to Europa kind of lagged along. You had the decadal survey, the new one come out, placed at number two. They recommended cutting the cost. You had a big study come out in 2012 that looked at, you know, these various ways to cut the cost on the flyby, and then NASA slashed the planetary budget. You know, it's just every step of the way, there's just been headwinds for this mission. Even with this Representative Culberson, he would add money every year. As I said, I think he added a good $200 million to NASA's budget over a few years, with NASA saying, no, thank you, every step of the way. And this is, you know, in the Planetary Society, we really started taking this up in 2013, and we've written hundreds of thousands of letters to Congress and the White House supporting this mission, our members have, I should say, supporting this mission. We've had a huge response from our members and supporters, and people really want this mission to happen. Even, like, simply, you know, whenever we talk about Europa on our website, our traffic spikes, you know, people are just fundamentally interested in this. And still, NASA wouldn't do it until you basically had the representative write in legislation that NASA has to do this mission, and then we found ways to, you know, NASA has to use SLS, going to launch sooner than later. But even now, NASA says, great, we'll do the mission. We formally accepted it and began phase A in 2015. We're making our contracts. We've got a science team. And NASA says, well, we won't really launch it until mid to late 2020. And even then, you're talking, so, you know, that's, you know, I want to be alive when data comes back from Europa. I think most people here want to be alive. And, you know, NASA pushed it back really far. So NASA would ask for, you know, NASA would get $100 million in 2015 by Congress to work on this mission. For 2016, they would request $30 million, right? Congress would then give them $175 million. So it's just jumping up and down. NASA requesting tiny amounts of money, Congress adding a ton of money. But to do that, you know, Congress actually has to pass a budget, right, which is becoming increasingly difficult as the years go by. And if we don't, if Congress doesn't always come up with that extra money every year, this mission gets delayed. And so even though we're in the position where this mission exists, there is a mismatch in priority between NASA administration and White House administration that controls NASA's, you know, requests and Congress itself. And, you know, who knows, that can change. Clearly, it may change in just a couple months. But it's been a very frustrating process. Again, this is a good example. We just can't take missions like this for granted. Even though we're in the process of formulation, we still haven't hit actually making it. We haven't hit your phase C, your implementation. So we still don't have a technical long-term commitment to the mission. You know, NASA has its out-ramp at the end of phase A and phase B if they don't like where it's going. So this is a mission, if you, again, I just, for people listening, pay attention to this if you want to see this happen. It's in a good place now, but we need to make sure that that support is maintained and people keep the pressure on NASA to keep this mission happening sooner than later, to keep it happening at all, and to make sure that, you know, the resources are there when the mission needs it to make it successful.
Why does NASA not like this mission? Why do they seem to want to oppose it?
That is a wonderful question. I guess, you know, I wouldn't say it's necessarily NASA itself. You know, NASA is governed by, you know, it's part of the executive branch. There's the White House. The White House has what's called the Office of Management and Budget, the OMB. That is what writes NASA's formal budget request year after year. And the budget request sets the tone of that year's budget discussions. It sets the president's official priorities for the agency. And, you know, the president has high priorities, for certain priorities for NASA. That's commercial crew. That's earth science. That's basically commercial crew and earth science. I would say are maybe the top two priorities for the president or for the White House. Then Congress, their top priority is space launch system and Orion, James Webb Space Telescope. Everything else kind of gets sorted out from that. And so, according to how the president's budgeting offices, I think, wanted to allocate money, and they, you know, they've been not giving NASA the best budget recently. It just didn't fit in. And so I think they resisted the idea. You can even go back a few years ago, Administrator Bolden was saying NASA doesn't want to do flagships anymore. So Europa, big flagship missions, it just, again, is a long way of saying I do not know why this resistance has been so hard. It has just been, I think, a purely a function of lack of interest and lack of prioritization based on what they have decided to focus on for NASA. It's very disappointing.
I've not met anyone who doesn't want the mission to happen. I think they want both Europa and Mars to go forward.
I think that's true, and I think the fear was, honestly, just to try to see their side more, was they had priorities with Mars, right? That they were worried that, so planetary science had a diminished level of funding or a diminished priority within NASA in general, and within that diminished funding, you had to make choices, and so they said, well, we'll go with the top priority, which is Mars, and we'll keep that mission going. We don't have the ability to fit in our future projections to have a Europa mission. Even if we request it, you know, we're going through sequestration and do giant budget battles with Congress. We don't know if Congress would actually fund it, so we don't want to try to push through two big missions at the same time, which is actually kind of what's happening now. It's riskier to do Mars 2020 and Europa together because if one of their budgets blows up, where's the money going to come from? So they're being very judicious in the context of planetary science being a diminished priority. And so I think, you know, no one is probably saying, I hate Europa. You know, I want to make sure no one ever finds out if there's life there. It's just a lack of prioritization. And they, even in the face of a congressperson, literally, you know, I think he would be literally giving them money and telling them, please do this. I will make sure you have the money. They just didn't believe it. I, you know, Congress operates, again, on this year-to-year funding basis, right? Anything happens to Culberson or something bigger politically happens, you know, you can't count on Congress always giving you extra money every single year because they have to make that decision every year. The budgeters, the budget people at NASA and at the White House, they're working in five-year budget plans. And this is, they know that they're going to be setting out these long-term priorities. So they worry, I think, of saying, well, can we count on Congress to give us this money? And they, you know, I don't know if you've heard, but the White House and Congress right now don't have the best relationship.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that. That's really?
Breaking news, everybody. Yeah. And so I think that's a part of it, too. There's just this general distrust and, you know, all of the symptoms of overall government issues, all of that trickles down to NASA at some level. So I'm sympathetic, but I also think that it was a huge missed opportunity because here was a way, if the president or the White House had reached out to the, particularly, and it's not just John Culberson, there's other supporters for this mission too, Adam Schiff, the Democrat out in California, Shelby, obviously Republican in the Senate side in Alabama, you could probably have reached out and formed a bipartisan support for this project in a period of very partisan distrust. And I think that was a missed opportunity on the White House's side to say, here's a place where Republicans want to spend money on this great science mission. We want them to spend money on science. Why don't we reach out and form a partnership so we're working together? We could have pushed this mission through a lot faster. So, you know, retrospect, hindsight's 2020, but going forward, I think the next president has that same opportunity, depending on what, even no matter which party they are, they can form a relationship and align NASA's priorities of planetary science in Europa with congressional planetary science in Europa. So hopefully we'll see a better alignment going forward.
Have you ever talked to Culberson? Why does he like Europa? What got him to really go after this mission?
I don't know exactly what the core source of it. I mean, he is honestly just very personally excited by it. He's just like any of us who sits and thinks about the consequences, the excitement, the impact of discovering life for the first time, extant life or second genesis beyond our own. And he reads the science papers. He is incredibly well informed about the mission, about the Europa science. He'll talk your ear off about it. He just seems genuinely excited by it. And that's so rare in Congress, honestly, to see someone so genuinely excited about space science. And he is putting his money where his mouth is, right? He's going to bat for this mission.
He's putting our money where his mouth is. Let's get that straight.
Use of our money.
Yeah.
Use of our money. But yeah, good point. But, you know, he puts that effort into it, right? A lot of people in Congress like NASA, but they will rarely go to bat for NASA, right? That's a big problem. Like, no one is really against space programs, the space program. But a lot of people won't make that effort to really support it when it comes down to it. He does. And, you know, I don't know where that source of interest came from. You know, he's got a long-time fascination in science. He's like an amateur astronomer. He also loves submarines, so there may be a connection there with the oceans. He loves the oceans on Earth, too. So it's an interesting alignment. It seems to me to just be a genuine curiosity and a genuine fascination with the potential of finding life. And he's been very good with the science on this. And he reads the papers. He engages with the scientists. He listens to them. He listens to what they need, and he just thinks this should be a priority, and I agree.
But before the show started, and we were talking about the show, you mentioned something called the NASA Transactions Act. What is this all about?
This is the NASA Transitional Authorization, or NASA Authorization Transition Act. Now you've gotten me all confused. The Senate has passed an authorization, well, the Senate committee, right, authorization bills, right? So there's two types of congressional bills that really impact NASA. You have authorization and you have appropriation. And in the ideal, you know, school of rock way of how politics work, you're supposed to have the authorizing committees authorize the existence of federal programs. They set spending caps They recommend spending levels, but they don't actually appropriate the money. And they set the policy, multi-year policies for these agencies. So you would have the last NASA authorization bill that actually was signed into law was in 2010. And that's the one that created the Space Launch System. That's the one that kept Orion going, that created embraced commercial crew or accepted commercial crew, kind of depending on your attitude. But it really sets the direction of these programs. Then year to year, you have appropriations bills, completely separate group of Congress people, completely separate committee. And again, they work on a year to year basis, and they actually provide funding that can or cannot, or they don't have to match what the levels were authorized by. So there's two broad types of bills. And NASA can function without an authorization. NASA cannot function without an appropriation. So the problem is this 2010 NASA authorization is getting a little long in the tooth. It expired 2 years ago. NASA basically still takes it as their congressional direction, even though it expired. So the House has been trying to pass an authorization bill for the last couple of years. The Senate has not taken up any legislation at all, mainly because of arguments over the authorized funding level. And this has been a big problem. Sequestration and limits, and they don't want to cut NASA's funding, at least parts of them. Some of them don't. It's kind of a big political thing they've been going through. So it's kind of a big deal this year that actually just a couple weeks ago, or gosh, maybe even a week ago, the Senate committee, this is the Science Committee, the Commerce Committee, that, and there's a Science Subcommittee there, created this bill sponsored by Democrats and Republicans, and its main issue was saying for the presidential transition, you have Congress wants to give guidance to the next president because they don't want a repeat of the Obama presidency coming in and upending the program of record, basically. And so this is you can say it's a shot across the bow, or it's just going on the record to the next administration saying the Senate believes that you should continue your big programs, SLS and Orion. You should keep Mars as your organizing principle of the human spaceflight program. They added a few extra destinations through to lunar space, moons of Mars, and then to the surface. Settlement is a goal for human space exploration. And then you had a variety of other things, talking about astronaut health, talking about refueling or servicing satellites in orbit, kind of a grab bag of stuff. But the big picture is saying, again, to the next administration, the Senate believes that Mars should remain the organizing principle of NASA's human spaceflight program. That's a really good sign. So this isn't law yet. We still need to be voted on by the Senate, and then the House needs to do its own version of it. Again, theoretically, both sides of the Congress would do their own bill. They'd merge it together in what's called a conference committee, bring it back to each chamber, vote on it again, and then the president would sign it. Notably, so the Senate introduced it in the committee. It got approved by the committee, which means the Senate should be voting on it. But the Senate now has recessed until after the presidential election. They won't come back to work until November 14th, and then they'll have about a month to do basically the rest of the country's business before Christmas, before their session ends, which means passing a budget, Trans-Pacific Partnership, maybe or maybe not doing a confirmation for the Supreme Court. Huge amount of work left. Who knows if something like a NASA authorization bill is going to get through. They tend to be uncontroversial, and so it could be an easier thing for them to pass through, but it's going to be tight just by a function of time. So it's an interesting step, and NASA listens to that. It goes out on the record. I'm glad it's out there, but a lot more work needs to be done. But it was an important piece of legislation that we just haven't seen in 5 years, really.
Interesting. Harry has a note for you from New Orleans, and he says, I don't think this is binding on the next president, so do you think there's any substantial difference from Hillary or from Trump, regardless of who wins? Do you think the policy would change dramatically?
This is in regards to what we're just talking about.
Yeah, well, I think he means, telling the next president, you leave us alone, we're doing these missions.
Yeah, at the moment it's not binding, and it would come down to how much political capital the next president would want to spend to upend the current program of record at NASA. And that's basically, I think, what happened in 2010, where the Obama administration proposed pretty dramatic changes to the space program. And the blowback was probably more than they anticipated. And the White House didn't have the political... They were trying to do health care. They were trying to do their climate bill. There's a lot that they were trying to do. Space wasn't the highest priority, and I think they found a way to split the difference, accept the congressional pushback for the most part, and have this kind of interesting hybrid program of commercial and your old school government methods of making rockets and crew capsules. So I don't, it kind of comes down, it's hard to say for either candidate because there's just so little information we've had about their space policies. We actually have been collecting their records at planetary.org/election2016. We've been just collecting all the statements that they've said about space. And generally it seems like Clinton has said that Mars is the goal. She visited an SLS supplier in Michigan. So that implies that she may be sympathetic to it. I would be surprised if either candidate has sat down and really thought about what they would want to do. Trump has also said good things about the space program. He's also said that he'd rather fix potholes before going to Mars. That was a long time ago, and so he said more consistent positive things since, but it's hard to say exactly what the priority of space would be in either administration. So I think it's at a point where they would say, okay, the Senate just put this bill out. We see that there's a bipartisan group of senators who are strongly supportive of the way things are, particularly with Mars. You'd probably see something similar in the House, even if it doesn't pass. And they say, okay, do I really want to pick a fight with this group of senators on this issue, or is this best left alone? And that's going to really depend on what they choose to do as president. So it's really setting up the chess pieces for the next Congress and the next president.
Penny is in Seattle with a sort of change in pace, maybe, and here is her email. David, I'm also at work, so I'm not using the phone today. And here is my question. Elon Musk makes his talk from Mexico about how he is planning to go to Mars, which is radically different from NASA's roadmap to Mars. Do you think that the Musk plans will influence or change NASA? Could, in fact, somehow Musk and NASA partner on Mars, freeing up some NASA money for Europa?
That is the big question, right? And this is what's interesting to me. I think one of the most important things that Musk's announcement with the colonization goal has been is to, in a sense, really validate the idea of colonization itself, right? And, NASA was never talking about colonization. NASA actually had a hard message. It was always kind of unclear exactly why do you want to send humans to Mars, right? And, there's a lot of reasons why, but there was no single reason why, right? And you saw this even... There was a National Academy's report from 2014, Pathways to Exploration, looking at justifications for human spaceflight at NASA. And they literally said, there's no single answer, but here are 12 good reasons. And that's not an easy message to make, right? When the public says, why are we going to Mars? NASA's like, well, here's 12 reasons why. When Elon Musk talks about it, why are we going to Mars? Oh, it's to save humanity. And that's a really simple message, right? You can say, we want to have a backup for human consciousness, and we need to colonize and have an independent base for humanity in the solar system. That is such a stronger narrative, that helps people, I think, see from that big picture perspective why that's important. For NASA, they've never been able to go that far, right? I think, again, colonization was never, I don't think, seriously discussed at NASA, particularly as a near-term goal. And so they talk a lot about science, but even then they hadn't made a real solid plan for going to Mars, right? You had this journey to Mars, more of an ambition, you know, some general outlines of working in fifth lunar space and then going there, but never, no hard dates, no exact infrastructure. And that's something we've really gone after them on, of you need to have this. So I'm wondering, I think what one of the consequences of at least Musk's plan will be, and seeing the general public excitement about it, is maybe NASA will have the leeway, or the will be allowed to take a stronger timeline, or at least a stronger ambition, and really lay out their Mars plan and say, all right, well, you know, Elon Musk is talking about colonizing a million people. We should at least be allowed to say what our detailed plans for landing on Mars would be and getting people to Mars. And I hope that's one of the outcomes, because NASA really needs to articulate this vision better, particularly when they're, again, facing with a much simpler message. NASA, I think, can make a good, you know, if you have, they're just categorically very different organizations, right? And I talk about this in a recent blog post that I did, that, you know, SpaceX has a blank slate to really approach how they want to achieve their Mars goals, right? They don't have a bunch of Apollo-era infrastructure and field centers and workforces. You know, NASA, you know, the NASA authorization bill from 2010 literally tells NASA that you need to use your shuttle workforce, your existing shuttle contracts or Constellation contracts, and your legacy hardware in order to make a rocket that can carry so many, you know, metric tons into low Earth orbit, and use your Orion. Like, it's very particular. NASA has to use their stuff, right, where they are, the workforce that they have. NASA doesn't get to choose, normally, right? Congress tells them they have to use it, part of being a federal agency. SpaceX can work with whomever they want, fire whoever they want. They can decide to go with a contractor or build something internally. They can create, they can choose, take a goal and work backwards at the best way to, you know, basically to figure out the best way to solve that goal. NASA kind of has to take the pieces that it has and assemble them in a way to achieve the goal, right? So there's an interesting difference there. So maybe there's a way they could work together, but the problem is, right, that NASA's invested and is building its heavy launch capability on its own. It's investing a lot of money in building the Orion capsule on its own. So I don't think that, I don't see them maintaining that program and investing in SpaceX to do the same thing with a radically different, radically new, and untested approach. I think what you will see is maybe an increasing pressure to say, how is NASA keeping up with this aspect of industry? But again, the big question there is, you know, and then this goes back to my kind of argument earlier, say that NASA decides SLS is not going to work, or the next, some president decides it's not going to work, or, you know, something with the political support collapses. There's no guarantee that the money that is currently going to the SLS and Orion and NASA's Mars Explorer, human Mars program, would continue to exist, right? It could very well disappear as those programs disappear, because the political support that has enabled those programs to exist and to drive those money to those places would also be gone, right? So that's the big question. Like, when Richard Shelby, senator from Alabama, is adding a lot of money to the SLS program, they're getting the budget of NASA higher than the president's request. I don't think he would go that extra mile to give that money to SpaceX, right? Because that SpaceX is based in California, not Alabama. And so, you know, you might have on paper, right, you can move the numbers around and say, oh, this seems like a much better investment, but this is that political angle. You know, how do you build a strong political support? So Elon Musk talked about this a little bit. You know, oh, maybe we can use Michu down in Louisiana to assemble these big pieces. And, you know, great, start, like, spreading your jobs out. But that's literally what the SLS is doing, right? Spread their jobs out, Louisiana, right, Mississippi, Alabama, and so forth. So it's an interesting question. It's a long way of saying I don't know. But I think hopefully NASA will see this and the public reaction. And they've been getting, one of the interesting parts of this Transition Authorization Act was that came out of the Senate committee was that NASA needs to provide a detailed strategic framework for how it's going to get to Mars. And we've been pushing for that for over a year now. And maybe the politics will enable that now that Elon Musk has had his own strategic framework out there for Mars.
Well, to the degree that Musk starts playing the game and spreading projects and costs around, his costs are going to rise dramatically. And some of the cost advantages of using SpaceX will start to lessen or disappear entirely.
Yeah, and that's actually kind of an interesting – this, I've always wanted to study this, and so I don't know if this is true or not, but I wonder if there's kind of a conservation of cost. You know, there's a minimum level of cost just by having the need of political support, right? Like, can you really – as you make things cheaper, you actually diminish political support in a sense because you are probably making fewer jobs in fewer places, using fewer suppliers. A smaller group of people who are invested in your program, you have a smaller coalition, right? It's kind of this weird reverse incentive, you know, versus spending a lot of money. A lot of people are getting a piece of it. A lot of people have jobs in a lot of places. You have a lot of people interested in this continuation. You know, this is why you see bigger projects, even when they go over budget, tend to survive because so many people are invested in them, while smaller projects that go over budget have much more risk of being canceled because they have a smaller group of people invested in their success. And so it's an interesting, you know, I was wondering the same thing. Wow, if Elon Musk is going to start moving into all these places, will the prices grow? But is that just essentially the cost of doing business? Is this, in order to succeed, do you have to spread money around? So I don't know the answer to this, but this is something that's interesting, is actually very worth further study, some academic study of how much, what's the size of the coalition that you need to be successful? If Elon Musk can do this without public money, that changes a lot, right? Then he doesn't need this consequence of it, right? He doesn't need as big of a political support because he can do it with his own money or investors' money, right? And you get a small group of people personally committed like he is, maybe you can pull it off. And so that's the interesting X factor about this whole thing is, you know, the most illuminating part of his presentation on Monday was this sense that this is his personal goal in life, is to make this happen. And he's not in this for the money. His company is not in this solely to make money, right, and to just exist. They're doing this for a grand vision that he appears to truly believe in. And he wants to, you know, he will commit his own fortune and his own company's fortune to seeing it made into a reality. And that's never happened. You know, we've never had such a strong vision driving a small, driving an individual who has his own rocket launch capability to go to Mars before. And so that, you know, that kind of upends a lot of this political, political side of things if you don't have public money. So it's a really interesting thing, and that's just historically unprecedented, right? So it's really hard to draw any extrapolation out of this because there's just nothing to go back on. This is brand new. So it's really interesting.
Musk is a very political savvy guy, and you can, there are websites and you could like search Elon Musk political contributions, and you can see how he spreads his money around, and he goes to both parties, although the Democrats are in power, so they're getting more. But even though I think I don't know for a fact, but I suspect he's probably more liberal than he is conservative. If the Republicans were to win, I suspect that Republican politicians would get a significant amount of contributions over what he's doing now. So because this isn't a business project per se for him, although he knows how to run it as such of a project, this has been, as you said, it's a lifelong ambition. So if he has to partner with NASA and the government and play the game, so to speak, he's probably, I would guess, willing to sacrifice some corporate efficiencies that he would have if this were all done in-house in order to get the job done, because that's, you know, his priority. There is no vision that gets implemented if he doesn't get the job done. So I would suspect that there is a cost to the project for doing this, and what that magic number is, I don't know, because the truth is he could try to develop this huge big rocket on his own that he wants to build. You know, it's going to take 100 people to Mars, and he could have nothing but problems with it, and it could turn out to be an SLS nightmare for him to build with, what, 42 engines that need to fire and on and on and on. I mean, that could be so beyond SpaceX engineering and technical capability that it could be a bigger problem for him than building SLS is for NASA. So you just don't know how to calculate the cost of doing business to get the project done versus trying to be a real efficient corporation and doing this as if this were a profit, you know, mission that you got to answer to your board of directors on and all of that kind of stuff. But I think there is a cost to this. It's just how do you calculate that differential? I think at this point it'd probably be impossible to calculate it.
Yeah, I agree. Since a lot of this is so new too, there's just not a lot of data to work with. And I guess I'd point out one thing is that SpaceX is already working, obviously, with NASA pretty closely and getting a lot of NASA money for cargo resupply and the commercial crew development. And, I mean, you've seen, you know, they've invested in building facilities in Florida and Texas and, you know, obviously in California. But, you know, it's not, I guess, at the levels we're talking about, the contracts they have, relatively small, I would assume, for what would be needed for the interplanetary transport rocket. At a level, I imagine it would cost a little more than getting Falcon 9 human rated. I mean, the interesting thing too, you're seeing them right now with the Falcon Heavy. They're going through this. I believe that rocket is entirely privately funded. I don't think any public organization has kicked into the development of that. And that one has just been, that's been tough for them, right? That's been delayed for years now, and they seem to be very close. And that's your, you know, quote unquote standard heavy lift rocket. It's not your like super heavy lift that they're making too. So it you know, rockets are tricky. I think they can ultimately figure it out because they have some of the best people in the world working for them. The question is, yeah, how do you keep the company viable throughout the entire time? Do you find, you know, a ton of interesting questions that we're going to start learning about here, answers to over the next few years. It's just unprecedented and pretty exciting time to be following it.
Yeah, it is, and I think he would probably come close to making a pact with the devil to get to Mars.
Hopefully it won't come to that.
And if the devil costs a little bit more or a lot more, so be it.
Right.
we're going to Mars, that's just the way it's going to be. I know we're a little over, and I don't know what your timing is, but I do have listeners that constantly contact the show and me because they really think there ought to be a human mission to Venus. And what do you know about that, or what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I'm not against it, right? I love space, but sure, let's send humans everywhere. I think that presents a significant number of greater technical challenges, and this may rile up a bunch of people who really follow this. But it seems to me if you want a big floating city in Venus with the consequences of not having it float being, you know, that you succumb into a high-pressure oven full of acid raining on you, you know, you have some greater challenges than setting up camp on Mars. So I think with what we have to do now, and also I guess the question is, what would humans do? Why would you go there? You know, you can say with Musk colonization plans, which I think is, again, a really logical reason for humans to explore, is having essentially an off-site backup of humanity. You can be... The goal there is to be autonomous. I don't know if you could ever be autonomous colony floating around on Venus. So it has to be a real question of why would you send humans there that that the robotics couldn't do at great, you know, or even like half or a third or a fraction of the cost. Why do you have them there? So that would be that's my initial reaction. But honestly, it's not a question I've thought about too deeply. It'd be awesome. Don't get me wrong. It'd be super cool to go to your floating Venus city. But I think Mars is much more practical as a starting point.
Maybe you go to Venus to save humanity too. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, if you, I think that I'd do offsite backup on Mars first, and then sure, it'll start spreading around. But again, I think the real question there. Mars is your offsite backup because you can theoretically be completely independent. I don't know if you can do that in Venus.
Well,
I don't know if that gives you enough to be completely independent.
When I've talked to Jeffrey Landis about this, and maybe it's time to bring him back on because he's always a lot of fun, at about 50 kilometers up in the Venus atmosphere, you're actually more... you're in an environment more like Earth than you would be on Mars. So being in the clouds at about 50 kilometers above Venus, you're in a pretty good Earth-like environment. So if you had multiple little cloud cities and you had a way to go back and forth between them inside some kind of protected bubble or spaceship, I guess you could have a lot of fun flying around the clouds of Venus. It'd be pretty hard to go down to the surface. That technology is not there. I don't know what you could even see from 50 kilometers up because the layers are really thick. But that part of the environment would be more Earth-like than being on Mars, is what I'm told.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, I mean, to me the big question is, where are your resources coming from to enable you to be independent, right? So at Mars you have, at least you can mine, you know, iron. If you need iron, you have the surface, you have minerals, you have ice water, or water ice and hydrated minerals. If you're in the clouds, you know, all of your stuff, even your raw materials, either you have a way to get them off the surface, which would probably be a robotic mining system that would have to launch it up, or you have some way of sucking it out of the atmosphere directly. But I don't. I see it'd be tricky to get your really heavy minerals that you would need to get your metals and your machines and, you know, all these kind of raw materials to keep things going. Right? Mm-hmm. You really want to get down into, like, where's, like, palladium coming from, or, you know, lithium for your batteries, or, you know, whatever you're using at that point. So that becomes, this is, to me, a function of, it's interesting, right, because it's the resources, fundamentally, it's a function of resource access. And this is what I think people argue on the moon, you still have that, this is your rocky bodies, at least give you some sort of hard resources and minerals and metal. Mars can get you that. Venus, unless you're in, like, your air-conditioned super bubble, or super air-conditioned bubble down on the surface, that what I would see would be the tough for being completely independent. Now, if you want to have a dependent colony in Venusian atmosphere, that's a little different. Then you would just get a lot of people shipping you, like, kind of like our Antarctic base stations now, that they're not independent, but they're permanently crewed by people who are doing research and things. That might, to me, be a little more reasonable.
Yeah, the Galactic UPS and Federal Express.
Exactly.
Bring you your supply. What should we have talked about, or what have we omitted that you wanted to talk about, or do you have any closing comments for us today?
Yeah, well, I can just say that, again, you know, to me, Europa, and I think to a lot of people out there who are listening, Europa represents just this is so exciting, and it's an opportunity, again, I think, directly test the hypothesis that life can take hold somewhere else. And if we discover life, it'll be one of the biggest scientific discoveries in human history. But even if we don't discover life, that's going to be a very important consequence, because that means that we're missing something out of our understanding of why life took hold on Earth, right? Because basically all the conditions, as scientists seem to understand them, seem to be the same. So even a null hypothesis, a null result, gets you a really interesting outcome in terms of science. And so I guess the fact that we can say, you know, are we going to decide in our lifetime to directly check the most habitable environment in our entire solar system besides Earth for living life. And the fact that it's still taken 20 years to get that mission on the books, given that opportunity, I'm hopeful, but at the same time, this is something that these types of missions exist because the public does react to them really well and does provide support. And you get lucky and you get people like John Culberson, you get lucky and Europa has spoons, you get lucky and, you know, you can find a way to align that with bigger programmatic issues. But overall, this is a function of the public being strong advocates and caring about missions like this to enable them to happen, to really push forward the bounds of the boundaries of science. So it's an exciting time, and it's something that we can all, in a sense, take pride in. And, you know, this is my plug for just basically be a space advocate, call your representatives, talk to people who represent you in government about how important space is to you, because that makes it, I can tell you 100%, it makes a difference.
Well, I guess we're going to see how things unfold and what happens after the election. I don't think much is going to happen before that, but I'm enthused about the Europa mission, so I personally hope it continues forward. And at 70, I hope they use SLS, because I'd like to be around and aware when it gets there.
I'm with you.
That's a big issue for me. So, listen, Casey, great to talk to you on the show, and I look forward to having more conversations with you on the Space Show, and I will let you know when the show is archived and posted and where it is, and we will stay in touch, and thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, thank you, David. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, and listeners, Open Lines is on Sunday. If you want to speak to your heart's desire about the Musk plan, this is the time to do it, 12 noon California time. Everybody have a great weekend coming up. Again, special thanks to Casey Dreyer for being with us twice this week, Hotel Mars and today. And everybody, again, have a safe weekend. Keep looking up.